Welcome to Here's to Your Health with Dr. Burns. I am Dr. Burns, and with me today, I have Dr. Maury Pressman. Dr. Pressman is pretty impressive here. It looks like that you're the chairman of psychiatry at Albert Einstein Medical Center, and you've also written a few books, too. So how are you doing today, Dr. Pressman?
Okay, I have to say I'm emeritus, meaning I was chairman. Emeritus chairman.
Okay.
But otherwise, I'm fine.
All righty. So, all right. Well, I see that you have been doing this for quite some time, you know, with the psychiatry, and with you said that you were exploring holistic spiritual psychotherapy. What is that? What is holistic spiritual psychotherapy?
I call it spiritual psychotherapy. It's really conventional dynamic psychotherapy, the kind that was started by Freud, and it's important because it gives an x-ray of the personality, so to speak. But to that is added all the new stuff of the powers of the mind, which can be summed up as supermind, powers that are enormous in terms of healing self and others, in terms of remote viewing, looking across the country, which the Russian...
Okay. So with this spiritual psychotherapy, is this lead you to the book that you have called Living in the Supermind? So, because it looks like here that says that we have the enormous power within us. It is the power of the God mind. But shrouded by doubt and fear, we leave the God mind and give in to the false belief that we are better off separate than united. The union is our natural state. So looks like this is part of living in the supermind. Says to a personal mind, from personal mind to spiritual mind here with your book. And I think that this is actually kind of fascinating that we have here with this. And so I guess we'll ask you a few questions here and as we try to go through and end up exploring this book that you've written and what inspired you to write it. So for everyone, and if you had any personal experiences with it. So in the meantime, it looks like that we've are experiencing a little technical difficulty at this time. But one thing is that you can't, when you're working on self, there's many aspects to it. There's the physical, emotional, and the spiritual. You can't leave one without the other. So all of them are actually integrated together. And where a lot of times, people think that they're, separate entities from each other. And a lot of times the spiritual aspect can even like over manifest what's going on with the other aspects of life. And especially when it comes to, other things that, have been, in with the training. Okay. Dr. Pressman.
Hi, Dr. Burns.
Hi. So sorry about that. It looks like that we ended up getting dropped. I was wondering about when you're going through and talking about spiritual psychotherapy, I was wondering, was that study what led you to your book, Living in the Supermind, or was it a collection of experiences that you've had that led you to write this book?
Oh, it's a collection of experiences. It's increasing knowledge. It's sort of a growth from conventional interest in the mind, conventional psychotherapy, into new things I began to learn in the area of energy psychology, beginning way back in 1978. I had a miraculous experience with Muktananda, who is a guru from the East that came over to teach Kashmir Shaivism here. I was lucky enough to have a personal meeting with him, but I was really a stiff-necked academician at the time, and I was wondering what I was doing there until I had this personal meeting with him, in which I found myself smiling in his presence. I found myself experiencing enormous love for this otherwise stranger and for the world at large, with an enlargement in my heart to help the world through my profession. He put his peacock feathers over me, and I began to feel those same injections of energy, a kind of experience I'd never had before. That was followed by meeting a number of advanced spiritual scientists, many of whom are in quantum physics, and Elmer Green, who was one of the founders of biofeedback. And I began to read in some of the Eastern literature, all began to go together as something which described much more profound aspects of the mind than I had been taught so far. I did not abandon, nor do I now, the principles, the psychoanalytic principles of the mind, which really give you an X-ray of the personality. But to that, we can add the depths of the mind, which lead into the such powers useful intuition, very useful intuition, such things as the influence of past lives on your present life, such things as the use of your energy powers to heal with your hands or with yourself, such things as the power of intention influencing the whole experience of psychotherapy and growth of personality, such things as the real power of hypnosis, all of these things depending on hidden powers of the mind, not accepted by conventional psychiatry, but nevertheless described by quantum physics, described by the ancient mysteries, and very evident in the way we live life, so that what I call spiritual psychotherapy is a combination of the personal, the conventional psychodynamic psychotherapy, plus these additional powers which can be released within people by the use of real introspection, real meditation, real use of intuition. And I can validate these things with examples.
So yeah, can you give us an example of something? So I like, how would you take someone from like where they're at right now to actually being able to like tap into their intuition? Do they need to go through like personal change themselves, getting rid of emotional baggage, or do you not need to do that in order to get into, you know, for people to be able to experience like true intuition?
Okay. You don't need to do that is the answer. Intuition is in everybody. It's there all the time, but it's smothered by the belief that it's called imagination, whereas in fact, it is a very powerful thing. We all experience it as hunches, and if we listen to them and make them sensible, they turn out to be pretty valuable. And you can enlarge that. But we all have intuition. We're taught to smother it. But if we acknowledge it and use it well, it gives you powerful access to knowing what's going on within yourself and also with what's going on in other people.
Okay. So can you give us an example, I guess, like of some people who like come to you or some things that you've seen to where you were able to like open up like your intuition or someone else's?
I went to Brazil with Dr. Stanley Krippner. He's an authority on dream analysis at Maimonides Hospital, but also a leader in this field. we visited what are called spiritists. These are volunteers, some of whom are PhD psychologists. One of them said to me, and this is a period in which I was full of academic skepticism, she said, you know, sometimes I can hear what the patient's going to say before they say it. And I thought that was pretty good, but I came back and began to pay attention to what I was feeling inside, and I too began to have the same experience. I can sometimes hear what the patient's going to say before they say it. Certainly that's true in terms of feelings. I can feel what the patient is going to is feeling without their yet being aware of it or yet being able to express it.
Wow. So, and then does that help you out?
I'm not describing myself. We all have these powers if we would only stop smothering them.
Right. How are we smothering them?
Well, first of all, by doubting that they're there, by thinking it's so unusual, by thinking it's a power that special people have, by thinking that it's only imagination. Well, imagination can be pretty useful, as it was in the case of Einstein, who discovered relativity, I believe, by riding a wave of light, discovered, or Archimedes in the bathtub, who suddenly had a eureka experience in his imagination about how to weigh water, what the weight of water was. In other words, our imagination can become very useful if we pay attention to it and also alloy it with common sense. But a lot of that comes through hunches, and we don't allow ourselves to be open enough to these hunches that we get. We get feelings about people. We get feelings about people who are good people and those who are not so good. We get feelings when we go into a holy place. It's a real feeling. We get feelings when we go into a place that's not so holy. It's these subtle feelings which are intuitive, which can turn out to be pretty important. It doesn't mean you lay common sense aside, but you, if you recognize them and pay attention to them and mix them in with common sense experience, they become very useful. And the more you use them, the more powerful they become.
And so do you think that people's own fears are holding them back from being like total into it or being able to recognize what's been given to them?
Yeah, fears like they'll think I'm flaky if I start talking like that, or fears that I may be going crazy if I begin to hear too much imagination. If a person is well integrated and live a well integrated life, they don't have to be afraid of that.
Okay. So, and then is it per person on how they can overcome their fear and be able to recognize what talents and abilities that they have?
Say it again. Is it what?
Are there like different degrees of fear that people have, you know, for them to be able to recognize their abilities and be able to use them?
Oh, sure. There are different degrees of fear, like there are different people. And it depends on the environment in which you are. I'm talking to you in a way now that I would, because you're, what I might say, you have a selective audience who's willing to listen. But if I were to talk to my academic friends, I would be talking much more carefully, you might say. So circumstances generate fear, but also conditionings represent fear. People have been raised in very fundamentalistic beliefs, are afraid of being open-minded and listening to such things as intuitive hunches.
Gotcha. So now what, I guess, with this, when you wrote this book, what type of person did you have in mind? Was it like just a typical everyday person or people who are really wanting to like dive into and really figure out, you know, like these hunches and what this imagination is?
I was rather naively of the belief that this is for everybody. In a sense, it is because everybody has these capacities. But I was wrong, because it depends on the kind of audience. It's written for an audience who are well integrated on the one hand, but who are seeking and who are open-minded on the other hand. And there are more and more people who are opening their minds to these so-called spiritual experiences. That doesn't mean religious experiences. It means exalted experiences. It means intuitive experiences. It means inspired experiences.
Okay. So, I mean, so when you've been around, giving presentations or lectures about your book, have you had people come up to you and say, like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize I could do this, and then I've been able to tune in a little bit more, and this is what I'm starting to find out?
Yes, it's a matter of planting seeds and getting things started.
And so how exactly do you plant seeds?
By talking to people like you.
Okay. I mean, it's like, have there been, people like close to you that you've planted the seed, but yet it's been like years, and then it's like all of a sudden they like get it, like what you finally were trying to tell them?
No, you don't have to all of a sudden get things. Some people do. I'm not one of those. In fact, I came to all of this stuff little by little by little by little. I take very small steps, but it's been a long time, so I've gotten to a certain place of a higher understanding. My wife, on the other hand, is psychic. When we had our first child, she died on the table.
Oh my goodness.
And she had a typical near-death experience. That was a long time ago. She was up in amongst the stars. She looked down at the body and heard somebody say, "I can't get a pulse, I can't get a pulse." She wondered why they didn't leave the body alone. It was so tired. But then she began to, she also felt the presence of some very comforting presence with her. And then she looked down and she felt sorry for her new husband and for the child that was about to be born, and came back into her body. At that time, I said, "Oh dear, you had a scopolamine psychosis." That's what I thought. But years later, when I began to read about these things and learn about them, I learned that it was a typical near-death, out-of-body experience. So
wow.
What I'm saying is that in this respect, I've been a slow learner, but other people have epiphanies. They get big insights. And the people that I talk to, some of them get slow development. Some people get an aha experience and take it from there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So as you're going through, I mean, I know it's like sometimes it's very difficult to, take all the years of experience that you have and be able to, put them into words, especially when it comes to like the intuit and stuff. Were you having difficulties putting like the feelings and stuff that you have into words to be able for you to actually write the book?
No, I wrote the book. I'll tell you how I wrote the book. First of all, I had written two previous books, so that made it easier.
Okay.
But when I saw Muktananda, I had this experience, and then I said, "How can I learn more?" And he said, "Meditate, meditate, meditate." I thought that was pretty simple and pretty dumb, but I tried it, and I couldn't do it. Why? Because I was too restless. I couldn't stand to sit still, let alone my mind be still. But I tried, and it didn't happen. And I tried, and it happened a little bit. And I tried, and little by little by little, I began to feel a kind of peace for a moment, and then larger moments. That's what meditation is, getting into that quiet mind, little by little, each in our own way. And then I began to get certain inspired thoughts, certain insights, which combined with things that I'd been reading in the Eastern literature, things that I began to see in my patients, and I said to myself, in typical neurotic, inferiority feeling fashion. Oh, well, that doesn't count. That's been said before, or it's only you. But I made myself put it down or dictate it, and then I transcribed it a couple of weeks later. And when I transcribed it, I said, gee, if somebody else had written that, I would have thought it's pretty good. So I kept transcribing them, and I put them together little by little by little. And I also found these examples in myself and in my patients, and I put it all together in a way that became what is now the book called Living in the Supermind.
Nice. So now with this that you did, like, little by little, and with and also with your patients, how do you feel that, like, through all this collaboration that you did with, you know, everything that you've learned, and was at first when you learned all this stuff, was it hard for you to teach other people about it, or was it something that came naturally to you?
No, I've learned in life to be tactful. What do I mean by that? I'll pinch people hard enough so they say, ouch, but not so hard that they run away. And I mean that symbolically. I'll start slipping in some of these ideas, even in the course of ordinary conversation, and I'll see what their response is. Some people become curious, and I'll go a little bit further. And some people seem to turn off, so I'll change the subject. We can all do that. The use of tact is a good thing, and tact is based upon intuition, meaning you begin to feel how the other person is feeling, and then modify what you say or what you're going to say.
Okay. So
I'm doing that now, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a lot of times I'll try to go off of my gut feeling on what exactly to say and what to do. But a lot of times for me, it's like I get something about someone, but it's like I'm not quite exactly sure if I should be telling that person what I'm feeling or if it's something that's just personally for me. So how would you go about letting people know, how would you go about, you know, like letting people know, like, when it is
just
time?
Just said something terrific, and I'll review it with you, okay?
All right.
You get a gut feeling. You don't know whether you should tell a person or not. So what you've illustrated are a couple of things. Number one, that you're using the witness, W-I-T-N-E-S-S, which is the self-observing self. You're observing the intuitive hunch feeling that you get, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you're thinking it over with your sensible cognitive self. You're also open enough not to dismiss it, but to wonder whether you should use it or not. So then you know your patient well enough. You take a chance. You see how your patient reacts. If the patient flinches a little bit but begins to show an interest, you use more of it. If the patient gets turned off, and you've only done a little bit of it because you're being tactful, then you wait for a while. We do this in life all the time if we're tactful. Now you can do it with introducing your hunches, which do open to and come from a higher and more powerful mind that we carry, supermind, if you will.
Yeah. So, and then I'm assuming then that one of the things to learn to do is to trust where exactly that intuition's coming from.
What do you mean by where it's coming from?
Well, you know, I mean, it's like sometimes it's like, is it coming from the supermind or is it just from us? You know, it's like, because sometimes people kind of like struggle with themselves. And it's like, well, you know, it's like, I kind of got this, but I'm not sure, you know, if that was just me or if it was, you know, something else because I'm concerned about, you know, I mean, like something else that's going on. So a lot of times it's like, I second guess.
It's always from the self. It's always from the self. Where else can it come from?
Well, I mean, it's like a higher power.
You mean it's something I've been told before? I'm just listening to somebody else. A hunch is something that you feel is real. You feel it in your gut.
Mm-hmm.
We each have ways of feeling our own intuition. I feel mine in my heart. Other people feel it in the solar plexus. Other people feel a chill all over their body. But we all know what a hunch is.
Okay. So, I mean, because sometimes I think that as children, we have those hunches and we follow them. But then as we grow up, you know, somehow the, you know, you get this muddleness that's in there where you try to, like, talk yourself out of your hunch.
Yeah, because we're taught to. Children are taught to talk themselves out of their hunches.
And so it's like then trying to reintegrate and get, you know, to trust that hunch. You know, I mean, it's like when something's there, it's like, you know, sometimes I like have this tug of war with myself is just like, you know, is it something that I just wanted or was this like an actual real hunch that I had? So sometimes I'm still like, don't know exactly like if it really is that hunch or if it was just, you know, something that someone else was talking about. I'm just like, oh, okay, well, that was a good idea.
Well, you're really, again, leading into something really good and really important. Is it something that I want or is it a real hunch? It's important to know yourself, and I'll tell you how you can know yourself. There is something inside of each of us called a center of truth. We can feel, if we let ourselves look inside, we can feel when something is honest, and we can feel when we're really pushing something, trying too hard. When you follow that which feels authentic, then you're following your truth and things come out better. Some people try to force themselves to be in love. You've seen that a lot. Or talk themselves into being in love and things like that. That doesn't come from a real recognition of a real feeling. You can feel there is a center of truth within each of us, and we get better and better at using it if we will look at it and test it out.
Okay. So now as people learn to use their intuition, do you find that people are, that their perceptions and their outlooks are different as they are able to go more in tune with their hunches?
Yes, because it's part of a larger picture. The more they trust their intuition in a sensible way now. You know, I don't mean that people should become schizophrenic. Schizophrenics are all too intuitive. They don't use enough common sense to mix in with it. But as people learn to trust their intuition more and to try it out in a way that's a bit courageous, they're growing in strength and in psychological strength and in wisdom. Their personality is growing. They're becoming more powerful and even better people. Although there are those who use their intuition for evil purposes. So, I've learned this somewhat to my own regret that psychopaths can be terrifically intuitive about finding victims.
Wow. So then how do people counteract something like that?
Oh, by knowing yourself, by being aware that there are psychopaths and, you know, using common sense along with your other capacities, including your intuition.
Okay. So, I mean, and then for those that do you have, you know, people who come to you and like want to change the negative that they have to a positive side?
Oh, all the time. That's why people come to me, because they have a negative side, meaning they're suffering.
Okay. So, and then with your background in psychiatry, do you sometimes, do you talk people through things, or sometimes do you feel that medications sometimes help people be able to get to their good intuition that they're needing? Like if they've got like a whole bunch of anxiety or depression.
First of all, I do use medication, but I never use it unless a person's in psychotherapy with me, because I think it's much overdone in psychiatry now.
Okay.
Psychiatrists will make a fast diagnosis, use one medication after another without knowing the person. I don't think that medication increases intuition. Oh, maybe with the exception of some strong psychedelics. I mean, they open the imagination all right, but perhaps too much. So for the most part, pharmacologicals do not assist intuition.
Okay.
They can be useful. I use them in conjunction with psychotherapy. I use them in order to help people be less afraid of anxiety as they try new experiences. Or I'll give you an experience from decades ago. I was chairman of psychiatry at Einstein at the time in Philadelphia, and I went into the Moss Rehabilitation Center, which was at the time a really terrible place. People had their amputations, and they didn't have much in the way of rehabilitation, or they had miserable residues of stroke. So you'd expect them to be depressed, and they were depressed. But we had some new antidepressants that came along, the tricyclics, and I thought I would try it. A crazy idea, because, of course, they had every reason to be depressed. Well, the fact is that they began to feel better and became a little more active, and a benign spiral was set up, meaning they began to feel better, they cooperated better, the staff felt better about them, the staff treated them better, and one thing piled upon the other to make things better. It wasn't the chemical alone that did it, but it was a whole combination of the assist, which the tricyclic, it happened to be Sinequan, gave to them, which set in motion certain personality factors or released them, helped them to get out of the depression, which improved the environment, and the environment then made them happier about life in general. And that's the way things work. They don't work singly. They work all together.
Okay. Wow. Yeah, I mean, I can see, like, I mean, I liked how it's like one thing built upon the other, because it was just like, and then everything, you know, ended up where it affected, like, staff and everybody else as far as, like, the improvements went with everyone. So, you know, with that going on, and, you know, from that aspect that happened there, I'm assuming then that from people's everyday lives that the same thing happens, that when they feel better about themselves, then the people around them, like, start to, I guess you say, like, relax and feel better, I guess, like, about themselves, because it's kind of like this ripple effect.
All the time. All the time. And can I bring intuition right here, for example? Don't you find people that you feel dragged down by, just by their presence? Don't you find yourself in the presence of somebody else who just makes you feel happier and more energetic, no matter what they're saying? These are exchanges of energies which we are emanating and which we are receiving, and we're doing it through our sensory apparatus.
Thanks, everyone, for coming back. I just wanted to thank all of our men and women in the U.S. military for supporting us in our freedoms, and ask everyone to support the USO. So I'm sorry, Dr. Pressman, you were talking about like intuition and about, like, you know, seeing if it's like us or if it's our intuition. And so do you want to continue that example?
Continue with intuition. Oh, yeah. I was talking about, we use it all the time. You were saying, yeah, there are some people that make you feel good and some people that make you not feel good, or something like that.
Yeah.
We all emanate. First of all, we're made of energy. We are precipitated energy, truly. But we all emanate energy as if we were radium crystals. And you can be around people that radiate energy that make you feel really juiced up and happy, no matter what they say. We've all experienced that. And you can meet others who suck energy out of you. Now, all of this is happening in a way that's going on beyond your five sensory apparatus. It's something that's happening energetically between people, and also something that you're perceiving with your intuitive apparatus all the time. Only we talk ourselves out of it. You know, if we feel that somebody's a drag, we begin to say, oh, we're being too critical. We shouldn't feel that way. But the fact is that you are feeling that way because they are causing you to feel that way. You're receiving it.
Okay. So then, which energy is actually stronger? Is the positive or the negative energy stronger?
It depends on who you are. We all have both. When you're depressed, the negative energy is stronger. When you're evil, or when you worship evil things, as some people do, the negative energy is stronger. Or when you use the negative energy dangerously, it's stronger. You can use negative energy like anger in athletic competition. Anyhow, the positive energy comes out, and what you're doing right now, you're trying to spread knowledge about better things like naturopathy and energy medicine and the goodness in people. So am I. So it depends on who you are. We each have both. If you want to be gooder, G-O-O-D-E-R, if you want to do good in the world, your positive energy is stronger. If you want to give in to being more powerful than the next guy and that's what's important to you, then your negative energy is stronger.
Now, in order for people to, not feel drained by someone else, is it, because there are a lot of, emotion, people who think emotionally or emotional into it, how do you get people to, block out the negative energy so then that way they're not so drained?
I don't think you should block it out, frankly. I think you should have it. I think that you should recognize it. But then you can do something that's better than blocking it out. And that is you can cultivate detachment. And let me say something about that. When you were saying, when we were talking about your attack, you know, you were noticing your hunch and you were wondering how to use it. You were using the witness within yourself, the self-observing self. Well, you can cultivate that self-observing self so you detach. You notice that the person is draining energy from you, and then you become less perceptive about that person, care less within yourself, or move on to another environment tactfully. But I don't think you should block it. That requires force in itself, and it's really not particularly genuine.
Okay. So then what is the difference then, between not taking things personally and blocking energy?
Well, not taking things personally means that you're exaggerating your own importance, doesn't it?
Maybe it depends on what exactly it is. Let's say someone is trying to purposely put you down. And is trying to make you feel really bad, but you're not letting it make you feel bad?
Yes.
So then how would that differ from, trying to, that saying that, it's okay for, some of that negative energy to, for you to feel some of that negative energy? Because, from what my understanding is that we're all good energy, so why let... so why let the bad energy influence you and bring you down?
Because you're a sensitive, feelingful apparatus. You're not a robot. So you're going to feel the negative energy. This happens to me all the time as a psychotherapist. In other words, somebody may be angry with me for whatever reason. I'll assess, first of all, if I've done something to offend the person, which I'm pretty good at not doing now. And if I haven't done it, then it's a carryover. Maybe I'm reminding him of his father, with whom he's venting some anger. So I'll look at that, and I'll assess it, and I'll still feel his anger making me feel angry, but then I'll bring it up for discussion. And with insight, he will not only have expressed his anger, but he will also feel less of it. So what's happened is I felt his anger, I have felt my response to it, I've evaluated it with my witness. All of this happens in a flash. And then I put it in its place. I haven't blocked it. I've used it usefully to bring insight to bear. We can do this in life all the time. We can watch. We can know ourselves well enough to know whether we've done something offensive or whether the other person is just acting, for want of a better word, pissy, P-I-S-S-Y, and then act accordingly. It's a wonderful thing to cultivate, to be able to cultivate that witness within ourselves and to use that kind of enlightened detachment well.
Okay. So, I guess I'm assuming this is something that someone needs to practice every day in order for to have detachment.
That's right. It's a good thing to practice every day.
Okay, and then how does someone practice something like that every day?
By knowing yourself more and more. One of the things that I really think people should do, we're all oriented to the outside. It's a very, very fast life right now. But I really advocate that people take 5 minutes, go into a quiet place or go into a quiet walk, and just look inside, getting to know themselves. As they do that, and feel a little bit of quietude inside, they will also notice the witnessing themselves, the self-observing self. They'll get to know their feelings. They'll get to know their weaknesses. They'll get to know their sensitivities. They'll get to know their strengths. And then they can use all of these things better. The process is called growth. It's called realizing yourself. It's becoming your authentic self. It's becoming your better self.
Okay. Now, I know that with the 5 minutes that you say to do this every day, would this be like part of the meditation that people should be doing? Or
yes.
Is this, or are there different types of meditation that people should be doing?
Well, there's a million types of meditation, and I think that it doesn't matter. Meditation is simple in its principles, and that is to really go into a quiet place, sit in a chair, and make yourself as comfortable as possible so you forget your body. You're just so comfortable you forget it. If you have a niche and it bothers you, just let it pass until you become quiet. If you have an emotion, like you're stirred up about something, let it quiet down. It will pass. If you have a lot of mind chatter, just let these thoughts float away until you get to a moment of quietude, like I did after Muktananda taught me. And then you're in meditation. You're in meditation when you're really in nature, walking around just with a quiet, peaceful mind. You're in meditation when you're completely absorbed in something which you're doing that you've forgotten. And meditation is like a funnel that leads from the ordinary mind into the higher mind that surrounds us, the supermind, from which you get these intuitive and these inspirational feelings. So I'm a big advocate of meditating, taking 5 minutes to do it, but each in your own way. And it doesn't have, you don't have to have specific mantras. You don't have to do it in a specific way. You do it in the way that makes you feel quiet in the best individual way that you know how, and then look inside, know yourself, and be open to hunches.
Okay. Now, with people needing to like open up and kind of be grounded, I know there's some people that say to like walk barefoot outside to start feeling grounded, or to lay on grass or something like that. Do you find that some of these things help people out to be able to physically be able to, relax and feel like in themselves?
Well, that kind of grounded is good because they're becoming one with the earth. By the way, that's also physiologically true. They're getting electrons from the earth. That's good. That goes into a kind of joining with the earth, which is a meditation. It is a quietude. It is forgetting the selfish, self-conscious self.
So that's why most kids don't like to wear shoes when they go outside.
That's one reason, and a very good reason.
So it's because they're more grounded than we are as adults.
Yes.
Okay. So, and what would be another reason for us to take off our shoes?
How does that sound to a naturopath? That must sound pretty real.
Yeah, it does. It does. So it's something that I try and tell my patients, because we are in such a world where it's so fast-paced emotionally and everything else, the instant gratification, that we actually lose that part and that energy, and that we do need to ground ourselves. And I mean, it's like I'll walk around outside barefoot, and it drives, you know, like some other people in my house nuts that, you know, like my daughter and I are walking around barefoot outside. Yeah, but to me, it's my way of, you know, of reconnecting and of, you know, with the energy of the earth and being able to actually focus better.
You'd be very interested in the work of a very good friend of mine, very good scientist by the name of James Oshman, Oschmann, who has written a book on earthing, Earthing, in which he proves scientifically that you are, first of all, isolated from the earth because we're wearing these rubber-soled shoes. Secondly, when we walk around on the grass, we're getting electrons, which we need in order to deal with our free radicals. We become healthier. So you're right on.
Nice. Now, is he the one who came up with, like, the earthing shoes and the earthing mat that I've been hearing about?
He's the guy that started it all.
Oh, wow. Neat. So how did you meet all these interesting people? Just from your journey?
Yeah, it's part of my journey. Really, I was lucky, but also, you know, I loved it, so I cultivated it. And I can introduce you to them, too.
Hey, that'd be good.
I can. Stay in contact.
Okay, it will. It sounds neat.
I mean that seriously.
Okay. Yeah, definitely. So I will definitely...
Can I put in the name of... Maybe I'm being premature. I do want to spread the name of my website. Can I do that?
Okay. Go for it.
It's the way my name is spelled. It's Maury Pressman. MauriePressman .com.
Okay.
Maury is Maurice without a C. It's MauriE Pressman.com. And there you'll find my telephone number, my email. I'd love to hear from you, and my books.
Okay. Yeah, and it looks like you've got some workshops and seminars and stuff to help people out with pain relief. And so, I mean, it's like, I know pain relief is a huge factor these days for a lot of people. And so you are able to help them be able to get through that.
Yes.
So that's amazing. And is it from the hypnosis, or what is it that helps people be able to, deal or work through the pain that they have for, say, like arthritis or degenerative disc disease?
All of these things work together. Hypnosis is a very powerful instrument, much related to meditation, by the way.
Okay.
And then there are various kinds of PMF, pulse, magnetic pulse machines, which we use, which can help. All these things work. Certainly understanding what's aggravating them in terms of worries and relieving that is very helpful.
Okay.
Group therapy is very, very helpful.
Okay. So
all these
things
are possibilities.
Okay. And then also, too, because I've noticed that a lot of people that are in pain, their energies are reversed. It's like it's not going the way that it should. So with some of this that you're doing, are you actually trying to, like, try and put their energy back to where it was, basically returning it back to the original state.
Yes, so that there's a flow. It's just like a laser light is powerful because all the beams are parallel. They're all in synchrony. That's the way the body works. All disease is dysrhythmia, rhythm out of rhythm. So what you try to do is to help people get back into the flow nutritionally, psychologically, physically.
Wow. So, yeah, I mean, it's like as a naturopath, we try to look at, like, everything in trying to get, you know, and trying to see what's going on with that person. So, I mean, and that almost seems like that's what you're trying to do with a lot of your patients and with people that you know.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, amazing. So, well, it looks like our show is about over with, but thank you so much, Dr. Pressman, for coming on air with me, and sorry about a couple of the technical difficulties that we had, but Dr. Pressman's email, our website again, is mauripressman.com, and we will have a little bio up about you and your contact information on our profile page for the for the show. So,
will you send me a link? Will you send me a link?
Yes, I will definitely send you a link for it.
Okay, and you promise to call me?
Yes, I will promise to call you.
Okay.
So, all righty. Well, it's good to hear from you, Dr. Pressman.
Thanks for the opportunity.
All right, you're welcome. All right, and thank you, everyone, for listening in.